Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. We're talking about Anna Karenina, Part 3, Chapter 6, by Tolstoy. Did anyone else find it funny that this podcast is called the Hemingway List, but we don't actually read anything by Hemingway? It's kind of confusing. Well, not really. Anyway, the crux of their disagreement seems to be common welfare versus personal well-being, according to Koznishev, though Levin doesn't necessarily agree. That was the discussion prompt I gave you guys for the previous chapter, for chapter 6. I Am Norwegian says, I don't think Levin knows how to put his argument into words. So he latched onto rational egoist position just to have something to articulate. Swim said, the mama fishy said, I would argue that Levin is an ethical egoist. Ethical egoism is the normative ethical position that moral agents ought to act in their own self-interest, whereas rational egoism is the principle that an action is rational if and only if it maximizes one's self-interest. So you think he's more of an ethical... So it's not as extreme by the looks of things. Right. Ought. They should act in their own self-interest. They ought to act in their own self-interest, but not necessarily... They don't see that an action is only rational if it maximizes that self-interest. Ivan Norwegian says, since he's a Tolstoy self-insert, I have a hard time believing that he is any sort of egoist given Christian principles. But I don't know how similar Levin is going to be to Tolstoy, or how his character development is going to look. I don't know enough about Christianity or egotismness to really comment. I don't really know what egoism is, but Christian principles seem very egoist to me. As a layman, it just seems seems like all about being a good person, love thy neighbor, be a good community member, forgive people, honor people's individuality, all that. You do all these things, which is like give, but all of it is at the bottom of that. The reason why you do it is for yourself, for your own self-preservation. But I'm an outsider looking in who doesn't really know much about Christianity. Never been a Christian. Never raised in any religious context. So, I don't know, that might be a bit of a strange thing to some. I think even a lot of people who are sort of atheist, I suppose, were raised with some kind of religion and then, you know, they come out of it at a certain age. But the religion was just never a thing to me or my parents. But they weren't non-religious, if that makes sense. They weren't atheists. It just wasn't something that was talked about, really. It's like they just kind of didn't care. Whereas people who are sort of firmly atheist seem very much to care. Maybe agnostic is what I am and what my parents were. I'm not really sure. Techrific says, I don't think Levin knows how to put his argument into words. That's it exactly. Most conservatives are great intellectuals, but we shouldn't judge them too harshly. Look at what intellectuals, especially in political philosophy, have done. Intelligent people wreak havoc every day. So maybe having a coherent political idea isn't necessarily the best one. I've said this before, but I think Levin is correct in wanting to go from the specific case of building it up into the general case carefully and methodically. Generalizing from an abstract case often leads to unforeseen problems down the road. As the specifics need to be accommodated, Levin is looking at individual needs. Humans are psychological beings, so emotional needs and emotional development is paramount to him. His brother just considers certain things worthwhile in themselves without considering its impact on the individual. Peace and order begins in the mind for Levin and in the world at large for his brother. This rift and problem is something we still have to contend with today, whether we recognize it or not. I think I'm probably more on the Levin side of things. I think you got to kind of project calmness out into the world if you want to create calm environments. And that approaching the world with the how do we fix everything attitude kind of suggests a need to be fixed. It kind of highlights that there is a problem in need of a solution. Maybe, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's more of having your head in the sand kind of thing that I'm about, you could argue. You could argue maybe I'm being ignorant. But yeah, anyway, me and Levin love a bit of the old ignorance. Jung quote. We've got a Jung quote here from I Am Norwegian, who says, I agree fully. The world, being as complicated and nuanced as it is, it's dangerous to crush it down into narrow doctrine. Rarely does the world imitate theory or jargon. It's been about 3 hours since I wrote something about Jung, so let me quote him. No language exists that cannot be misused. It's hard to realize how badly we are fooled by the abuse of ideas. It seems like the unconscious has a way of strangling the physician / intellectual in the coils of his own theory. Well, I'll give you 17 seconds to think about that while I go and get my drink out of the fridge and not edit out this moment of silence. Enjoy this moment of silence. Just have a think about Jung. Have a think about life. Now that is how you podcast. Delicious. Today's podcast is brought to you by the beverage. Max Aid Berry Blast Flavor Isotonic Drink. Which is a Aldi brand of sports drink. Did you ever think? Did you enjoy that moment of silence? Did anyone out there get the stopwatch out and see how close I was to being correct about it being 17 seconds? I bet someone did. I bet you I wasn't far off. All right, Jung. As soon as we get down the rabbit hole of comments to Jung territory, that's where I cut and run. So there's a lot of replies to that Jung quote, and I am going to skim past them all. Not that I don't love a good bit of Jung. It just gets a bit much, doesn't it? Me reading out things that I don't understand. Nifty Riffic said, "We already know that Constantine and his brother are rather different people, and I enjoy some of their nuances. Telling how Koznishev was home sipping iced water with Levin whilst Kostya, in temperatures too hot for his brother to venture, was sharing metallic algae water in the field. Then I got sort of fixated on the idea of the fruit that thrives in a subtropical climate, garnishing a glass of water in 19th century Russia. My thought was that perhaps lemons may have been more of an imported fruit, being sensitive to frost, of course, or perhaps just grown more south. Wikipedia said the lemon is thought to be native to South Asia." Really? I wonder if Levin had a greenhouse or an orangery, and if that would have been a standard thing on an estate such as his, boxed citrus brought indoors like at Versailles. In childhood, Tolstoy's first published novel, There is talk of an orangeinary in the chapter of the letter that reads, "Spring is coming in beautifully. We keep the door on the terrace always open while the path to the orangery is dry and the peach trees are in full blossom. Only here and there is there a little snow remaining. The swallows are arriving, and today Lubotshka brought me the first flowers. The googling of Russia and lemon brought me to Leo Tolstoy's favourite dessert, lemon ank pie, which is butter, sugar, eggs, and lemon juice, which sounds right delicious. Attempted to find Jung's favourite food and couldn't find anything, so I'm guessing it's something like sausage." You reckon it's something like sausage? I reckon it's another lemon-based food. I just think it is. You know, all the great minds of our history, they all love their lemon-based foods. Lemons and oranges, very easy to grow. They'll grow anywhere. And they'll grow especially well in cooler climates. So I reckon they would have been growing their own lemons and oranges there in Russia. Easy peasy. There was something up the top of that comment that I was going to go back to. Oh yeah, the difference between the brothers. I really liked how Levin had been out there in nature, in the world, all day, cutting grass, you know, bugs all around, you know, the birds, the sky, the fresh air, the hot sun, and just loving it, loving being out there in all that, as tiring and kind of annoying as those things can be, he was loving it. And then his brother staying indoors all day, having iced lemon water or whatever it was, didn't want even just a fly to come into that house. Like, he wanted to keep nature completely. He wanted no part of anything that was happening out in the world that day, even just one fly coming into his space. Very opposites. Sorry, I'm drinking so much during this podcast. I went and worked at a winery today. A good friend of mine is a chef at a winery, and they do a big jazz day, and it was a very lovely spring sunny day here in Melbourne. It's the first day of daylight savings, so summer is well and truly on its way. And she called me yesterday and asked if I wanted to help them doing some waiting, table waiting, and helping out in the kitchen and stuff. I said yes. It was a lot of fun. I definitely wore the wrong shoes, though. I thought, oh yeah, you know, it's a fancy winery. I'll wear these nice leather shoes. What I didn't realize is that I'd be walking around on concrete for like 7 hours. And oh my god. Oh my effing gee. My feet were killing me. And I think I got a bit sunburned as well. So I'm just loving this Max Aid Berry Blast flavored isotonic drink. Gunaro, hey Gunaro, haven't seen you for a while. Gunaro says, "Hey, I'm back. August and September were crazy busy. I'm part of an understaffed IT department for our local school district, but I had time to get caught up lately. Good to hear. Haven't seen your name for a while, it seems. I'm glad you caught up. I don't have much to say about this particular chapter, but these last few have been my favourite of the book so far. I am in love with Tolstoy's descriptions of mowing the grass, and I wholeheartedly believe in this idea of arbeidskur. The PNV version translates this to work cure. I think the modern day equivalent would be unwinding after a long day at the office by hitting the gym and doing some intense weightlifting. I can imagine this would seem crazy to those who are required to do heavy labour to survive, but for those with white-collar jobs, the hard work is a nice escape from the mental gymnastics of a normal day." Techrific says, "Welcome back," and so do I. And also, funny you say that, because this hard day's work that I did today, running food around and clearing tables and stuff, and my feet were killing the whole time, and I was out in the sun, and I was sweating, and I was thinking, why did I wear jeans? I should have wore shorts. just regretting everything I wore. But yeah, it shook me up a bit. It woke me up. You know, I'm a writer and teacher and sometimes an Uber driver and a podcaster, and these are all great things to be, but none of them really require me to do much standing up. You can do all of those jobs sitting down, except for the teaching bit, really. But it was good. It was good. I felt the most awake today that I have for a few months, I'd say. So, yeah. Work cure. I can attest to that. I've nearly drunk a whole bottle of Max Aid Berry Blast Isotonic Drink. That's 750 mL. No artificial colours or flavours. For those playing at home, 133 kilojoules of energy. I think I might have got a bit sunburned, and that's why I'm so thirsty. Chapter 7 of this book goes like this. A blunt, it doesn't have a sniff at the start. That was me improvising. Doesn't have the clearing of the throat either. Oblonsky had gone to Petersburg to fulfill a very necessary duty, which to officials seems most natural and familiar, though to laymen it is incomprehensible, that of reminding the ministry of his existence. Without the performance of his right, continuance in government service is impossible. Having taken away with him all the money there was in the house, he contrived, while attending the duty, to pass his time very pleasantly, going to races and visiting at country houses. Meanwhile, to curtail expenses, Dolly and her children moved to the country. She went to Ergushovo, the estate which had formed part of her dowry, about 35 miles distant from Levin's Pokrovsk, and the very place where, in spring, the forest had been sold. The old mansion on the estate had been pulled down long ago, but there was a smaller house which had been enlarged and decorated by the prince. Some 20 years before, when Dolly was still a child, that house had seemed roomy and convenient, though in common with all houses of the kind, it stood away from the drive and had not a south aspect. It was old and beginning to decay. In the spring, when Oblonsky went there to sell the forest, Dolly had asked him to look over the house and to have all necessary repairs done. Like all guilty husbands, Oblonsky was very anxious about his wife's comfort. So he looked over the house himself and gave orders to have everything done that seemed to him necessary. According to him, it was necessary to reupholster the furniture with new cretonne, to put up curtains, make the garden tidy, plant flowers, and build a bridge by the lake. But he forgot many other things which were essential, and thus caused Dolly a great deal of trouble. Try as he would to be a considerate husband and father, Oblonsky never could remember that he had a wife and children. He had the tastes of a bachelor and understood no others. When he returned to Moscow, he informed his wife that all was being prepared, that the house would look like a new toy, and advised her to move thither. Her departure for the country suited Oblonsky in every way. It was good for the children, expenses would be cut down, and he would be freer. His wife, on the other hand, considered going to the country for the summer to be absolutely necessary for the children, especially for the little girl who had not recovered from her health after the scarlet fever, and also in order to escape the humiliation of small debts for fuel, fish, boots, and so on, which tormented her. Besides this, she liked the idea of going to her house in the country because she intended to get her sister Kitty, who was to return from abroad at midsummer, and who had been ordered bathing, to join her there. Kitty wrote from her watering place that nothing seemed so attractive as spending the summer with Dolly at Ergushovo, which was full of childhood memories for both of them. The first days in the country were very trying for Dolly. In her girlhood, she had lived there, and it had left an impression on her mind as a place of refuge from all the unpleasantness of town. Life there, though very plain, Dolly was reconciled to that, was cheap and comfortable. Everything was cheap there and easy to get, and it would do the children good. But when she came there as mistress of the house, she saw that things were quite different from what she had expected. The day after her arrival it poured with rain, and in the night the rain came through into the passage and nursery, so that the children's bed had to be carried into the drawing room. There was no scullery maid. Of the 9 cows, some, according to the dairymaids, were about to calve. Others had calved for the first time. Some were too old, and the rest were difficult to milk. So there was no butter, and scarcely enough milk even for the children. There were no eggs. It was impossible to get a chicken, and they were obliged to boil and roast tough old purple-coloured roosters. No peasant women could be got to scrub the floors. They were all out planting potatoes. It was impossible to go for a drive, because one of the horses was restive and would not run in harness. There was no place for bathing, the river banks being all trampled over by the cattle and exposed to the road. It was not even possible to walk in the garden, because the fence was broken and the peasants' cattle could get in, and the herd included a terrible bull that was given to bellowing and would therefore probably toss. There was nowhere to hang dresses, because what few wardrobes there were would not shut, and else opened for them of themselves when anyone passed by. There was no mangle in the laundry, not even an ironing board, and no large pots or pans. Dolly, meeting with these difficulties so terrible from her point of view, instead of finding peace and rest, was at once driven to despair. She bustled about and did her utmost, but, feeling the hopelessness of her position, had to fight with the tears that rose every moment to her eyes. The steward, formerly a non-commissioned officer, to whom Oblonsky had taken a fancy and whom he had promoted from hall porter to steward because of the man's handsome and respectful appearance, took no interest in his mistress's troubles, only saying in a deferential tone, "Quite impossible, the people are so abominable," and did nothing to help her. The position seemed irremediable. But just as in other households, there was here, in the Oblonsky's house, one inconspicuous yet most important and useful person, Matrena Filimonovna. Oh my god, what a mouthful. Filimonovna. She consoled her mistress, assuring her that everything would shape itself. This phrase was her own, and Matthew had learnt it from her. And she went to work deliberately and without excitement. She at once made friends with the steward's wife, and on that very day of their removal, drank tea with her and with the steward beneath the laburnums, discussing arrangements. A club was soon established beneath the laburnums, consisting of Matrena Filimonovna, the steward's wife, the village elder, and the office clerk, and by means of this club the troubles began gradually to subside, so that in a week's time everything had really shaped itself. The roof was mended, scullery made, a relative of the elder's was engaged, hens were bought, the cows gave enough milk, the garden was fenced in, a mangle was made by the carpenter, hooks were put into the wardrobes, which no longer opened at their own sweet will, an ironing board covered with coarse cloth lay sweet lay across the arm of a chair and a chest of drawers in the maid's room, and the smell of hot irons soon pervaded the room. "There, you see, and you were quite in despair," said Matrena Filimonovna, pointing to the board. Even a bathing house was constructed out of straw-plated screens. Lily started bathing, and at least part of Dolly's expectations were fulfilled, if not that of a quiet, at least that of a comfortable country life. Dolly could not be quiet with 6 children, of whom one would fall ill, another be in danger of falling ill, a third be in want of something, a fourth show symptoms of something bad in his disposition, etc., etc. Very, very rare were the short intervals of quiet. But these cares and anxieties were the only kind of happiness possible for Dolly. Had it not been for them, she would have been left to her thoughts about the husband who did not love her. Besides, painful as were for a mother the fear of illness and sorrow at the appearance of evil tendencies in her children, those children were already beginning to repay her care by affording her small joys. These joys were so trifling as to be as imperceptible as grains of gold among the sand, and in moments of depression she saw nothing but the sand. Yet there were brighter moments when she found nothing but joy. She saw nothing but the gold. Now in the country solitude she grew more often aware of these joys. Often when watching her children she made great efforts to convince herself that she was mistaken, that being their mother she was not impartial. And yet she could not help telling herself that they were charming children, all the six, each in his or her own way, all of them such as are rarely to be met with, and she was happy in them and proud of them. Alright, there we go, it's another chapter down. Sounds like Dolly is quite the country lifestyle person too. Seems to be really enjoying it. Suits her. Have your say about this chapter over at the subreddit. Thanks for listening to this podcast today. Sorry it was a bit of a blah one. You did well to get through it. I'll see you tomorrow.